This is David Colburn. It's February 24th, 2009. It is 1:30 p.m. and I'm interviewing Dot Whittle about her experiences during World War II. And Dot, why don't we just go ahead and get started and tell me and the tape recorder how you got to the Philippines the early 1940s.
Okay, well, I was born in the Philippines. So I was born in 1931, in the bottommost island of the Philippines, which is Mindanao. And it's the second largest island. My brother was born in Luzon, which is the top one and the biggest. So I was there from 31
until... And your parents were doing what?
Okay, my family has a mixed up history. My dad was, his family came over from Scotland. So he was a Canadian. He was born in New Brunswick. And then he came with his aunt down to Wisconsin because his dad died. He was a ship captain. So, and my aunt went up to try to help because there was no insurance or anything and they had five children. So she picked my dad to come down. And he babysat and took care of her children. And then the deal was that if he wanted to go to college, they would send him. And so he chose University of Wisconsin. He majored in agriculture. And then he got, when he was through with school, he wanted to see the world. So he went out to Oregon with his brother and they homesteaded. Well, his brother didn't like homesteading. So he came back to Wisconsin. And so Daddy decided he wasn't ready to settle down that way yet. So he got on a tramp steamer in San Francisco and told him he could cook, which he could only cook one thing, which was Mulligan stew. And he always said that the reason they left him in the Philippines, or he probably missed the boat, but anyway, because they got tired of his Mulligan stew. So there was another ship coming in 6 months, but he thought, well, while I'm here, I just might as well see if I can get a job. So the Philippine government, which of course at that time it was a territory of the United States, they hired him to teach agriculture to the natives of the Philippines and help them become better farmers. So they sent him to Mindanao. Now, my mother...
And that was when, Dot?
He probably... had worked 22 years when the war broke out, and he lost all that retirement. So you subtract 22 from 45, and that would be how many years? And I don't really know. But 22 years,
you
probably.
You take it from 45, not 41?
Well, we still stayed in the Philippines because we were there till 1945.
So about 1923.
Yes, probably about then. Okay. Now, my mother, her parents were Canadians also, and her father was a doctor and also a minister. And so they went to India, and mother was born in India, and she stayed there till she was 18. Then she came back and became a nurse and was trained in Toronto to be a nurse. And then she went to China as a missionary. And while she was in China, she had to leave. So she went down to India and got on the boat in Bombay. And my dad was coming on furlough from the Philippines. And that's where they met. So then they met, married, and went back to the Philippines. And so
it was fate for them to meet.
It must have been. It must have been.
I mean, coming from almost two different parts of the world. So they both... how long before they married?
Well, they married within the year of meeting because Daddy had to get back from his furlough, and so they married and came back and settled in Mindanao, and I was born there. And
what did they do, and what did your mother do in Mindanao?
She was a housewife because they had me pretty soon, and mother always was real happy that, you know, it was a legitimate length of time, but they were older. Daddy was 40 and mother was, I think, 37 or something. And so that was pretty old back then to have children.
Children, yes.
Mm-hmm. So.
And what was your life like there? How old were you when...
The war started.
The war started.
Okay, we stayed in Mindanao till I was about six. And then we came home on furlough to his family in Wisconsin and visited. And then we went back to the Philippines. And my brother was born in Luzon. So, and when the war started, I was 10 and a half. And Daddy did the same thing up in Baguio, which is in Luzon, that he had been doing, which means the people came with their whole families. The natives came with their whole families. They lived in dormitories, and Daddy taught them, and they had a working farm. I mean, it wasn't just theory. And so then they had schools for the children, and it was just, they did a lot of good.
And what was your daily life like as a child there?
I had a wonderful time in the Philippines. I had no idea that everybody in the world didn't live like I did. It was very much like the life I would have had in the States. I didn't go to kindergarten because I didn't have kindergarten then. But Mother taught me with the Calvert course. I don't know what company sponsored it, but, mm-hmm. I learned all my colors and numbers. And so she taught me kindergarten, basically. Mm-hmm. So...
And public school, did you go to public school with the native children? Or
No, I didn't. And most of the American and English kids didn't. I went to Mary Noel, which is a Catholic school. And then I was fast becoming a Catholic, and Mother and Daddy decided they'd switch to the Episcopalian school. But we were Methodists. But everybody went to either Brent or Mary Noel. And so Brent... was one that was run by the Anglicans, and that's where I had just entered fifth grade when war broke out.
Mm-hmm. And the school curriculum was just like the curriculum back in Canada or in the States?
Yes. They tried to keep us 6 months ahead of the United States so that would allow for traveling time. Mm-hmm. And so then in camp, when they taught us, we didn't have any books at all. And so it made me realize as a teacher that, as a student that I utilized as a teacher, that you don't need books mm-hmm. to be a good teacher, And we.
So when did you realize war was coming?
I realized I was probably, the war broke out in December. I would say... those months before the war, I knew something was happening because my parents were stocking food in the basement, and they were staying up to listen to shortwave radio, and were listening to Churchill and Roosevelt, and I knew something was wrong just by them getting up in the middle of the night to listen to the radio. And I'd go out there, and I heard their voices, but I didn't understand what was going on, and I didn't. Children of 10 don't really pay that much attention as long as everything seems to be okay.
Were your parents anxious about being in the Philippines at that time, or did they think that war would not come there?
Well, my mother wanted us to leave because the military people the dependents were being evacuated. And Mother said, that's a bad sign. We need to be evacuated. We need to go back to the States or Canada. And my dad said that the Japanese would never attack the United States. And so by the time he decided, well, maybe something was going to happen that he didn't really like, it was too late to get out.
Yeah, the attack on the Philippines.
Was the same day, Pearl Harbor. Yes, a lot of people don't know that. And a lot of people don't realize that there were civilian prisoners of war during any war. Mm-hmm. I imagine you mm-hmm. have them. And so...
So what happened initially when the Japanese attacked? They not only bombed Pearl Harbor, but they invaded, they not only bombed the Philippines, they invaded the Philippines.
This is true. They also bombed Singapore and Borneo and Malaysia and, different places.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a pronged effect. They went to Pearl Harbor, but they also came down. And we weren't that far from Japan. Mm-hmm. When you think about it, you look at it on the map, it's no wonder they attacked there.
Mm-hmm.
And I forgot what you asked me.
Well, they were just obviously attacking the Philippines mm-hmm. because that would expose their flank if the United States mounted an offensive at some point. And there was no natural items like oil in the Philippines, was there? Oil was in Indonesia, as I
recall. Well, they had gold, okay, and they had a lot of food, you know, stuff. Mm-hmm. But they had mining companies up where we were, okay, and so there was a lot of wealth. And I don't know. They did the same thing to the Philippines that they did to the States as far as the airplanes were concerned. You know, they bombed Clark Field, and they tried to hit the places that could retaliate in some way.
Now, after the bombing, was there any chance of getting out once the bombing occurred?
There wasn't any chance before the bombing because the ships had stopped leaving the Philippines. And I don't think people flew as much as they do now. You know, when we traveled, we went by ship, which mm-hmm. takes forever and a day. But I guess some people flew home, but a lot of the people just stayed. Mm-hmm. And you look back on it and you think, why would you stay? But when you've invested, you know, your living and it was very, since it was such an American territory, I mean, you know, I had dancing lessons and I was in the Brownies and we had church services and they had movies. I mean, it was amazing. It was just like the States.
Just like a small American town, yes, in some ways.
Yes, it was.
Now, when did the invasion affect you?
It affected us on the 27th of December. After we were bombed, my dad came and got me, and I never went back to school because, well, nobody knew what was going to happen. So you kind of waited till the other shoe dropped, not knowing how it was going to come or what was going to happen. So we had Christmas. I think we had it early. Well, I'm sure we did because we didn't know what was going to happen. And so they phoned the house and talked to, I think, Daddy, took the call, and they said they wanted us to come in and register, and they were going to put us up for the night in the Pines Hotel in Baguio.
Now, who was this? Was this?
Japanese.
Okay.
And so they said to come in and register. We could bring one suitcase, and we could come home at the end of that day. Well, that was the next day we got up, took our one suitcase, and we never saw our house or our pets or anything, because we never saw the house again. And so they recorded us as being there, put us in a room, which didn't seem, you know, too bad. And but they woke us up in the middle of the night, and then they moved us to Brent School, which was the rounding up point for all the Americans and Canadians and the British and the Australians and the Dutch and whoever they were at war with.
And this was in Luzon. And so what happened at Brent School?
We stayed there for a couple of days. It was kind of miserable because there wasn't much food and nobody had much of anything. And so we did the best we could there. And then they moved us, that we walked to Camp John Hay. And that was a very traumatic thing for me because they separated the children from the parents. And looking back on it, I think that it was a really smart ploy to get control of the parents. You know, like, you mess with us, we'll take the children. Mm-hmm. Because my dad had diabetes, he was on a truck and he was moved, he couldn't walk. So he was on a truck and went taken off one way. So then they kept the bulk of the adults, and then us children were taken. So my mother told me I was responsible for my brother, who was 4 at that time. And I was very frightened because I think I was more frightened than a lot of the kids seemed to be. I don't know. I just realized this was serious, you know. And she wanted me to promise that I would get him back to Wisconsin to my aunt. Well, I had been across the Pacific, and I knew how far it was. And I knew that when we got to California, that we still had a way to go to get to Wisconsin. But, you know, I said I would take responsibility for my brother, and I really don't believe I ever gave it up until he died. Mm-hmm. You know, I just felt everything that it was, I took it for life. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize I was going to, but I did.
Now, your parents went where?
This day that we're walking?
Yes.
Okay, we're going to Camp John Hay, which is...
And they're going to John Hay, too.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
But they... And so that night, we were reunited. Oh, later okay. that afternoon. But we didn't know that.
Okay.
And see, and the Japanese took us one way.
How long was it? Was the walk to John Hay?
5 miles.
5 miles.
Mm-hmm. About okay. 5 miles.
Mm-hmm. And when you got there, what did they do? Did they process you again, or did they assign you to...
As I recall... As children, I think the adults walked faster than we did or something, which would make sense. But they, I don't remember what we did, actually, till our parents came. I think we just sat around. We didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And so once the parents got there, everybody was in one barracks. And so I think Americans are very good at organizing. And so once they realized that this was the way it was going to be, some people started saying, okay, we've got to divide up the property. We're going to put, the floor space. We had no beds. So they put the men in one section, put the women and children in another, and got it organized. But it took a while to get food coming in, and you had the space of a mattress mm-hmm. for each person.
And this
everybody was on the floor.
This was approximately December the
28th.
28th. And you were there...
Maybe the 29th.
How long were you in the John Hay facility?
We were there for a couple of months. Okay. Then they moved us...
Well, tell me, before we get to that, what was your treatment like?
A lot of the Japanese, who were our guards and who controlled us, had been Japanese that we had known in peacetime Baguio, because they were businessmen. And they were sometimes laborers, you know, just like the Filipinos.
So they've been living in the Philippines.
Yes. And mm-hmm. so some of them, we knew some of them, but it's very hard to go from not having control to being in control. You know, sometimes you go a little overboard in the show-offness and that's not a word probably, but...
And the way they treated you.
Yes, they got very... demanding, and they had not had good treatment before the Japanese captured us. What had happened was, a lot of people don't ask me this, but what had happened was the Japanese in Baguio were rounded up and put in Camp John Hay, where we ended up, and they did not give them particularly good treatment. They didn't beat them or anything, but they didn't feed them much. And it took them a while. And so some of the people that were in our camp said, this isn't right. We need to feed these people. And the Japanese remembered that. And those were the people they wanted to be our leaders. Because they had been kind to them. And I can understand that.
Mm-hmm. And how long had they been gathered up? Was this after the bombing of Pearl Harbor they'd been gathered up?
Or? Who, the Filipinos?
The Japanese. Yeah.
Well, see, some of them were actually local people mixed in with the military who took about 3 weeks to get up to us. The place was crawling with them. I mean, there were a lot of them. The surprise was amazing. You know, we just weren't prepared at all.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know it happened to MacArthur and Bataan and Corregidor. I mean, we lost all our forces, and that was awful that happened to them.
I'm trying to figure out, when were the Japanese rounded up themselves and put in a camp?
As soon as the Japanese attacked the Philippines, the army wasn't there yet.
Yeah.
So that some of the people in Baguio decided, well, we need to get rid of this threat of the Japanese. We need to put them in, we need to get them in one place and guard them so that they can't cause any more confusion.
So sometime after December 7th.
Well, when the Japanese got to Baguio, they released them.
Right, right. So sometime around, they were in prison. They were in a camp themselves until somewhere around December 26th or so.
Somewhere along in there. Okay. Yeah.
All right, and you were at John Hay about 2 months. Did you say?
Yes, 2 to 3 months.
Okay, and why do you have any idea why they moved you from there?
Well, we were very crowded for one thing. We were also interned the Chinese, and because they weren't happy, I guess the Japanese and Chinese have fought for years, you know, and so they interned some Chinese, and they did let them go after a while, and so our men were able to move into that dorm. But we had two dorms side, oh, two barracks side by side, and then a tennis court. And that's all the space we had. So there were 500 of us crammed into those two buildings, and they had to move us. We couldn't, well, I mean, they didn't have to, I don't suppose, but it was a whole lot easier for everybody once they did.
Now, what was your day like there at John Hay? Was there any education going on?
We tried at first, and then it didn't work. So we kids were very delighted that they decided this was not a good idea. But when we moved to the next camp, you know, the adults got themselves organized. They realized we might be in for the long haul. So it was not very exciting, actually. There wasn't any place, as a child, there was no place for us to go much. And there wasn't anything to do. You just had what you brought with you. And I think the children were a nuisance because we kept running, you know, when they wanted us to walk in the building. And the tennis court was where they organized what they could, and the men went and got exercise for the tennis at a certain time, and then the women went a certain time, and then the children went at a certain time. And the reason for that was they didn't believe in the men and women commingling. They didn't believe that men and women should do anything together. So the only way you could see your dad or your husband or your wife would be as we walked to the tennis court. And that was very hard.
Yeah, I can imagine. Mm-hmm. And you went from John Hay, where did they take you next?
They took us out to Camp Holmes. Now, my dad had we were in a place called Trinidad, which was right outside Baguio, about 7 miles. And he had this beautiful area that the men were being taught to, and women were being educated, you know, to raise crops. They had flowers and vegetables, and they had some horses, and it was just a beautiful organizational thing. Okay, well, this was in Trinidad Valley, down in the center, mountains all the way around, and Baguio was over here. Well, they took us by trucks right by where daddy had been the principal of the school. And Camp Holmes was a Filipino constabulary camp, where Camp John Hay was where the Americans had been stationed. Camp Holmes was where the Filipinos were trained to be their military. And so we had so much space out there compared to what we had had. We had three dormitories and a big parade ground, and it was a lot better.
And at Camp Holmes, you were there for how long?
2 years and a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. We were interned for 1,135 days, which was 3 years and 2 months total. But most of the time was spent at Camp Holmes.
And Camp Holmes, what was the daily routine like?
Well, they got themselves organized when they got to Camp Holmes. They got a committee of men and women, and they gave the space out, you know, about still a mattress space for everybody. Then they assigned jobs to everyone, and the women cleaned the rice, and the men did different things like go get the wood or take the garbage out, or my father worked in the kitchen. And so they got us organized, and they put us kids in school. We had lots of people who knew how to teach. We had it because a lot of educators were in the Philippines, and some of them had been on their way to China and had been turned back to the Philippines, the missionaries. Mm. So we had probably 40 certified teachers. We kids didn't stand a prayer. You know, they were everywhere. So we had a great education, actually.
How many children were at Camp Holmes?
There were 125 of us.
And adults, approximately?
There were 500. 500
total.
So 300, yeah. So there were about 350 or whatever that would be.
And what was the interaction with the Japanese like in at Camp Holmes?
All right. At Camp Holmes, we were fortunate. We had a missionary who was very fluent in Japanese. She had been raised in Japan because her parents were missionaries. And she had learned the high-class Japanese. I didn't realize that there was a different kind, but they really respected her because she knew this high-class Japanese. So she was our interpreter and go-between. So our person who was elected chairman was a minister, Carl Eschbach, and Nellie Kim was the interpreter. And what they would do is they would go down to the guardhouse in the morning after roll call, and the Japanese would tell them what they wanted us to know, what they wanted us to do, what was going to happen, and all that kind of stuff. They tried to intercede where they could and tried to modify whatever, or just sometimes had to come tell us what it was we were going to do. And we were very fortunate to have people that took hold. And there were about there was a committee of about five men, and they didn't want any women to be on the committee because this was a man's thing. But we had five women who also helped, you know, because they just took care of what they had the women do.
Mm-hmm. And what other than school, what did you have chores you had to do? Did you have to?
We helped whatever our parents' job was, we helped.
Okay.
And so mother did rice. And the way they did it was we had a table, sort of like a cafeteria table, and they'd dump all this rice on it, and we'd sit with cloths in our lap or pans or something. I don't know. There was something that we sifted the rice into, and we'd sift it and bring it toward us, and we'd take out the sticks and the bugs and rocks and whatever, and then that's what we would eat.
And that was was that the only food you had?
Or it was could
you
our grow? Main diet the whole
rice
time.
Rice was the main diet.
One time the Japanese decided it would be a great idea for us to have a garden, and we had three different gardens. And the thing was, they didn't let us have all the food. They took a lot of it. Mm-hmm. So somehow or other, our produce amount degenerated. I mean, we were feeding them. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't any animal that got into camp that got out alive. Like if mm-hmm. a calf wandered in or a chicken or whatever, you know, we mm-hmm. didn't leave. We had some vegetables. We got one Red Cross package. I ate horse meat while I was in camp. I don't know, you know, where the horse came from, but we had carabao, which of course are the native animals that do all the hard work. I guess it must have died because we sure wouldn't have killed it if, mm-hmm. you know. We got one Red Cross package. We were supposed to get more.
What was in the Red Cross package?
Oh, my goodness, what a wonderful thing that thing was. It was, I have a list somewhere of all the things. There was, there was coffee. There were cigarettes, which the parents swapped for milk and butter and Spam, and it was all canned stuff. Oh, I know that's not all. There were some clothes that came with it. Oh my goodness, what else would have been in there? You want me to go get my list?
Oh, that's okay. That's fine. It was a pretty good sized package.
Yes, and each of us got one, and I would say that saved our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Because as the war got worse, the food got worse. And we ate. There was a time when they let the Filipinos bring stuff into us, like my dad's students brought us things. But then we were getting messages of what was going on, you know, and so the Japanese decided that we'd done enough of that, so they stopped that.
So they stopped the Filipinos from bringing things in.
Yeah, because they'd write notes in the vegetables and things.
And tell you, mm-hmm. so your parents knew
a little bit about
how the war was going, at least had a rough idea.
Right, and the only message that my dad was able to get out, each family got to send to one relative. And so my dad sent my aunt in Wisconsin a note. Well, it was a postcard, and it was pre-stamped, and you signed, and you checked, we are alive, we are well, we are happy. So my aunt got that. I wish I had that. I don't know what happened to it.
And any sense of fear while you were in the camp?
I would think, yes, I was. I think once you realize that you're in it together, I think that's very helpful. You know, there was a very close-knit group of people. We were very fortunate that the adults... Okay, I try to tell students when I talk to them, we were an unusual group of 500 because most of the adults had college educations. And if you were to take 500 people off the street in Gainesville and put them in the same kind of compound that we were in, it wouldn't be the same because they had all told their families goodbye and had made the adjustment, you know, to being in a strange country with whatever was going to happen. So I think that there was just a knot of courage and ingenuity in the group that we were. And that stood us in good stead. Ask about fear. As a child, I didn't like roll call. My number was C92, and they would holler and scream at us, you know, and sometimes they would punish somebody who had done something wrong. They patrolled the buildings all the time.
What was the punishment?
Oh, they took the people into town, and some of them died from torture. And
were these children?
No.
Just adults.
They were good to the children. We were scared to death of them, but they were good. And to us, they didn't mistreat any children. And we figured they missed their own children. Most concentration camps, I don't think, have children in them. And so we were fortunate. And we were a peaceful group. You know? We didn't try to cause any confusion. So
why would somebody, if you're a peaceful group, why would somebody get pulled out? And
because, that's a good question. But it's because they thought, my mother and dad had a chance to go hide in the hills. His students offered to hide us. Well, some of the people did take to the mountains. And so the Japanese would torture some of our missionaries, particularly because they thought that they knew where they knew who was missing from the. They got the city list or something from Baguio. I don't know how they knew, but if you had anything to do with the people that were missing, well, then they tortured you till you told them. And even if you didn't know anything, they didn't believe you. Mm-hmm. So some of the people died.
I see. That were tortured. And how did you, were there church services? Did you have the camp arrange for?
At first, there weren't because they didn't let us meet in groups.
Okay.
They didn't even let school, I mean, not that we could have done anything, but they didn't even let school be in session because they were afraid for us to get in groups. And so then finally they decided, well, they would try it. And I guess they kept begging them to let them try school. They finally, when they gave permission, they went out and tried to find books, you know, from Brent. And we had about one book per class. And we had to pass them around.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I was in the sixth grade, we decided we would lose the math book. And so, well, the teacher knew it was in camp somewhere. So she said, well, that's okay. If you've lost it, you'll just all get zeros till we find it. And so somehow I was innocent on that one. She could have looked at my face if I'd had it.
Now, how did you celebrate holidays? I mean, the calendar was almost meaningless because you're there for so long. But did you celebrate birthdays and holidays?
Yes, you did it very frugally. But yes, but back to the question about meetings. They finally decided that it would be all right to let us have church services, and there always were Japanese in the wings, you know, and so they rotated around to all the different denominations, and So what was your question? I'm sorry.
Well, I was asking, did you celebrate holidays and birthdays? And
we did. Of course, we celebrated the holidays. And birthdays were kind of skimpy as far as the gifts, but we understood, you know. Mm-hmm. And they'd make things, people would make things for each other, like mother ripped up a sweater and had somebody re-knit it. And your gift would be an egg, maybe, or a banana.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a big deal.
Mm-hmm. You were, in some sense, you were fortunate to be in an environment where you could grow things almost year-round, couldn't you, in the Philippines?
But, you know, we didn't have the garden except when they gave us permission to have it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if they tried to get permission to continue to have the garden, but it was one season we had it.
I see. How big was the camp? I mean, could in distance, was it surrounded by barbed wire? Or
Barbed wire. And there was no way, really, that the barbed wire could keep you in if you tried to get out. But I'm sure that the adults had been told, if somebody leaves, you know, we torture the rest of you. Mm-hmm. And we did have two men before we were moved to Manila who did leave, and they left right after nighttime roll call. And that caused great confusion. We had had a commandant who was not a military man. His name was Tumibi. And he was a very good man. He was, I think, a college professor. And the war just caught him up, and somehow he got to be our commandant. Well, he wasn't a military person. He'd been educated someplace in the Philippines, I mean, in the States. So he was a good man. Well, when these two men escaped, then he paid the price, not of losing his life, but he was released, and we got somebody who was really mean. And then that, of course, meant that a lot of the people were taken in and questioned and tortured to see if they knew that the men were going to escape.
Mm-hmm. How big would you say the compound was?
In my mind, as a child, it was pretty big. Mm-hmm. I would say several acres, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's a good distance you could walk around if they let you.
Oh, yes. Well, we could go anywhere in that area. Mm-hmm. You know, it was wonderful. It was a good climate, except for the rainy season, but when we had typhoons. But the children were supposed to travel together at all times, and the adults never let us out of their sight. There's no way we could have done anything we weren't supposed to do. But we had enough space for a softball section that they, you know, tried to play baseball. And then we had a parade ground because it had been a military place. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a big clay area, and I would say several acres. It was an ideal place.
Mm-hmm. How did you know, did your parents share with you the information they heard about the war?
We had lots of rumors. I think a lot of the time, now there was, I found out after we left camp as an adult that they had put together a radio that I think maybe, you know, very few people knew that they had it. So we had a clear shot to Lingayen Bay. I don't know if you're, or Gulf, I don't know if you're familiar with the Philippines, but
really.
Baguio is up here in the mountains, and we had a view on a clear day. We could see Lingayen Gulf between the mountains. Well, before they moved us to Manila, we could look down through the mountains, and we saw puffs of smoke, and we knew that an airplane had flown over, but this was after we'd been in there for a while. But I don't think the children knew much of what was going on. I think mainly because they didn't want us to inadvertently say anything about it. But we had, in school, I finished the 5th grade, 6th grade, 7th grade, and 2 weeks of the 8th. And then when we came back to the States, my dad decided I needed to go to the school in Neenah and take some tests to see where I was going to go the following year. And I just really thought that was the cruelest thing that ever happened to anybody. For one thing, we had come from this small community, you know, and then there were 3,000 students in that building. I was terrified. But anyway, I took some tests and I passed into the ninth grade with a B average. But and my dad had a good point. I mean, you know, he said, all right, that's fine with me. If you won't go, you'll just be in the fifth grade. And you're almost 14. And so I, let's say, saw the wisdom of his suggestion.
So when did you first catch a glimpse of the war changing and that your life here at the camp might be changing too?
Might be changing. Well, a plane flew over that had stars on the wings. That kind of, we went berserk with that. And then, of course, the Japanese were horrified that we had seen that. So that was the first clue. We had everybody set a date when they thought the war would end. You know how that goes when you're don't have anything else to do. And we didn't have any idea we'd be there as long as we were. But we could hear bombardment through the mountains down at Lingayen. And I don't know. I think some people must have known, but here again, the vast majority of us didn't know.
Mm-hmm. And did you know, or do you recall when that plane flew over or what year it was?
They moved us in 44, so it must have been in 44. Okay. They moved us in December of 1944 down to Manila. And so that the plane had to be in 44 because that's when the invasion started.
And when they moved you, did they say why they were moving you? Or
no.
What the purpose was?
No. No.
So you woke up one day or you were...
We woke up one day and they had roll call. They told us we were moving within the next 2 days. And we moved by truck down. That was a wild trip. We went down the zigzag trail in trucks. There were and there were two contingents of us. There one went the first day and one went the second. And they had about 15 or 20 POWs in the truck, and then we had about 5 guards. And the trail, we went down the mountain trail, and it was, I remember looking over the side of the truck. They were open trucks, and I remember looking the side, and you could just see these canyons, you know, and it was really scary. And then our rice spoiled on the way down there because it was so hot. And we were very fortunate that particular day. I've talked to military men since then, and they were bombing those days down in the lowlands when we finally got there, but they had been sent on there was a battle in Lingayen Gulf, and the airplanes weren't there that day. We were not marked with Red Crosses and so there were so many times when we could have been killed and we weren't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just was amazing.
Now, was there high anxiety when you were moved to Manila?
Yes, because we didn't know. We did know that Manila was in bad shape, and that the we could hear the war as we got close to it. We were really in the thick of the battle. You know, the American planes were flying over, dropping bombs, and the guns were shooting off the ships, and there was just fighting. It was just terrible noise. And by this time, we were very weak. Very sick. They even stopped school. That's how even the kids didn't have any energy.
Hmm. What were you eating in Manila?
They ran out of rice, so we were eating cornmeal. We had about 800 calories a day, and so that was about all we were eating. And some people still had a little bit of the Red Cross stuff. Most people divided it up. They divided it into about 12. That was just a wild guess. And actually, it went longer than a year. But some people just ate it all, you know, and that was pretty dumb.
Mm-hmm. You were in Manila how long?
Okay, they moved us in December. and we were released in February. We were released, the Americans released us, and they were in Manila. Well, I don't know how long it was when they were in Manila, but a tank went behind us on the 3rd. So Santo Tomas, which was a big camp in Manila that had 6,000 internees, they were released on the 3rd. We were released on the 4th. But have you ever seen the movie, The Greatest Raid?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know how time, they were all going to be extinguished, and they just got them right out of the Japanese hands. We also were supposed to be killed on the 6th of February. And so we were released on the 4th, which that's another thing that boggles my mind.
Now, when you were moved to Manila, were there just the 500 of you kept together, or did you become part of a larger compound?
All right, that's an interesting question, too. We were put in a camp called Bilibid, and Bilibid was the national prison of the Philippines before the war. And then it was decided that they needed to build a new Bilibid because this one was unfit for human habitation. It was built in a circle, and then it was compartments within the circle with a big tower and then towers, you know, all along. It was 16 feet high and about 12 inches thick concrete. We were in concrete buildings. We were in one compound at the end. You came in the gate, and then there were all these circles, and then we were at the end, and we were in a three-story building that the top thing was had been blown off. So we were in some cells, and you know, with all the bars on them, and so that's where our family was. Across the wall from us were the Bataan and Corregidor survivors, the ones that had been too wounded and ill to be sent on the hell ships to Japan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they were actually, when the 37th Infantry got there, they had a hard time convincing them they were Americans. They thought the Japanese were, you know, trying to fool them so they wouldn't, trick them to let them in. So they wouldn't do it. Finally, they realized they were Americans. But they told them that they thought that there were Americans in the next compound, and they said they thought that there were children over there. So that's how they found us. It was by accident. Mm.
So they could just hear your voices. That's why mm-hmm. they thought there were children over there. Mm-hmm. Did the Japanese flee before the Americans took over the camp? Were your guards gone?
Okay, you're asking really good questions. The Japanese were retreating up to Baguio, where we had come from. That was their last stand up there. So they were fleeing, but before they fled, they killed 100,000 Filipinos, and they just completely tore up the city. I mean, what the Americans didn't bomb, the Japanese just blew up. And so, yes, they were deserting the city. But we had our guards until the morning of the 4th, and they called us for a roll call, and we were in our compound, which, again, was very small. It was smaller than the one we'd had at Camp John Hay. I mean, you know, we had a small one, then we went to Camp Holmes, then we came to another small one. But anyway, they called us for roll call, and then they told us that they were going to be stationed somewhere else and for us to stay in the compound, that it was safer, and that they were leaving us. And as they exited Bilibid, they were killed at the gates.
And no effort to kill any of you?
No, it was scheduled for the 6th, and I guess they were staying with their routine. They could have done it, I guess.
Yeah. Seems to me they could have when they rounded you up that morning, they could have...
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, we were in a space probably the size of this house.
Mm-hmm. Were they the same guards you had had up at Camp Holmes?
No, I don't think they were. The guards kind of came and went. Mm-hmm. And we found out that the ones from Formosa or Taiwan were not as avid as the Japanese were. And they were taller. They were more friendly. But our parents, of course, wouldn't let us have anything to do with them, but we could tell.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, and we didn't see any of them in Manila that I remember. Mm-hmm. But they were fighting for their lives and probably knew what was going to happen mm-hmm. to them.
And once, when the military freed you, what happened?
Well, we stayed in Bilibid for a while. They came in the middle of the night, which was wonderful. My dad went out, and he was so excited. A lot of them were from Wisconsin. And of course, they looked so healthy. It was amazing. And so they kept us there for a few days. Then they trucked us over to Santa Tomas. And we were at Santa Tomas, which we lived in tents. Out, and that's kind of hot in the Philippines in the blazing sun. But we were glad. Now, something that happened when the Americans had rescued us, the Japanese had set fire to the Pasig River, the Pasig River runs through Manila, and they didn't set fire to the water, but the buildings that were down at the Pasig. Okay, so the fire was approaching our prison. So the Americans thought, there was a rumor that the Japanese had put us there because they were storing ammunition underneath the prison, which would have made sense, you know, you blow up that, they get everybody at once. But so when the Americans rescued us, then they realized that the fire was coming this way, so they knocked down this back gate, and we went to a shoe factory. And so we had to walk to the shoe factory. But that's an interesting story of how they were trying to fight a war mm-hmm. and trying to get us to
take
safety.
Take care of prisoners of war at the same
yes,
time.
Yeah. And so we had saved a few things from the Red Cross packages. And so, you know how you just save things and don't know how you saved them. But the Filipinos thought we had gone for good, so they came in and looted. So literally, when we walked off with our one little suitcase, we had one change of clothes. When we got back to Bilibid, we had what we had on.
Mm-hmm. Were the GIs surprised that there were so many children?
Yes. And they were so glad to see, you know, Americans. And, of course, we were delighted to see them. Oh, yes, they gave them rides in their Jeep, you know, Jeep, brought them candy. And
how long was it before they were able to evacuate you from the Philippines?
All right. Now, Daddy was a naturalized citizen. And when we got back to the States, Mother became a naturalized citizen. But at the time, she was Canadian. Now, and that was a big worry to Mother, that they would separate people by nationalities. Mm-hmm. And so that would mean that my father and Hugh and I would go off into one section and she'd go off. And, you know, and you think of Sophie's Choice and you realize right. this stuff did go on. The totally American families were supposed to leave before the rest of us who were from the mixed nationalities. So they took them to Lady. And they were going to fly them home from there. So we came home on the USS Eberle. And we left, I think it was like the 8th of April or something like that. And they took us out with LSTs out to the Eberle, which was a troop ship. And it was funny because we beat the ones that, some of the groups that were totally American. You know, Mother always felt stepped on because we were mm-hmm. we're supposed to be later. But, you know, Daddy told her, he said, look, I don't care when they take us. Don't complain. So it was soon after, but it was, I would say, probably a month after they, maybe, because here they were fighting the war, too.
Yeah. Remember? Were any of the Corregidor veterans on your troop ship? Because I would have thought some of them could not fly.
Oh, some of them. One man in that group had held on until the Americans came, and then he died. He gave up. I don't know. They just couldn't believe it that he died mm-hmm. after he was released.
Mm. And did they go back on the troop ship with
we
you?
Had there were 6,000 people on that ship, so sure, well, we had some troops going back, and then there were a lot of us, and there were some from Camp Holmes also. We were crossing when President Roosevelt died, and that we had a funeral on the ship for him. Mm-hmm. And we traveled in blackout, and we had a destroyer escorts, and there was a storm in the sea that upset all of us down in the hold. Mm-hmm. It was really rough, but and we dodged evidently a submarine. So there was a lot of stuff that as a child I just didn't know, and I'm just fascinated to read. Mm-hmm. You know, it's amazing we made it.
Mm-hmm. And you got back to the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. May the 3rd.
And you were at San Francisco? Or?
No, we were at, oh, good gracious, we were below Los Angeles, not San Diego, San Pedro.
Okay.
We landed in San Pedro, and we were processed off the ship, and then we stayed in L.A. for a while, and they gave us took us shopping and got us some clothes. Then we were put on trains and sent to various places. My aunt and her and my uncle had to vouch for us, and people who didn't have anybody to vouch for them had to stay until they found somebody.
Hmm. So did you go to Wisconsin mm-hmm. from there?
We went to Wisconsin. And we stayed there. Well, Daddy realized he had to get a job, so he went to the university and got recertified. And then he started applying, and he applied to places that he thought the weather was sort of like the Philippines. And in retrospect, where we were in Luzon is very much like North Carolina, or the Carolinas, you know, the mountains and the different seasons. There wasn't ever any snow where we were, but Florida was hotter than Daddy had planned on. But Florida answered first, and then he got an offer from California, but we came here.
Mm-hmm. And so that was
in 1945.
45, mm-hmm. You came to Florida.
Mm-hmm. We were back home before the war ended.
Yeah, yeah, the war ends in Japan in August of 45.
Mm-hmm.
How did all of that affect you? How did that shape your life?
Well, it obviously made me who I am in large part. I'm just so grateful for the adults in camp who were they took such good care of us kids. And I don't have a doubt in my mind that if we had been in danger, they would have given their lives to save us. They taught us so much by their, just the way they coped, you know? They never gave up. They never gave up hope. They tried to find humor where they could, although it wasn't very easy. They tried to get organized and take care of what they could control. And it was just a lesson in just surviving. That's all. I got a good education. I was very close to a lot of people. We have concentration camp reunions, and we're just like a family.
You do? Do you have them annually?
Well, no, but they're getting annual now because there's so few of us left. But in fact, if it hadn't been for my eye, I would have been at one out in California. And then I had signed up for a tour to go to the Philippines because it was Baguio's 100th year.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, and I had to cancel it because of the surgery, and the doctor wouldn't let me go anyway this soon. And so I'm going to try to go again, though. I never have been back to the Philippines. I never have wanted to go. But now I kind of think maybe I could. I've been through my brother dying. He died in October, which I had a really hard time dealing with that. And I think it was because I just felt responsible for mm-hmm. him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he was younger than I was. But I realize, I don't know, there were just a lot of lessons. I realized you can teach school without books. I realized that there were people who did good things in camp and some people who did not do good things, and we punished the group, the committee put one man in the bodega, which is his storage building. They put him down there, and they isolated him. And the Japanese couldn't believe that we had put one of our own in isolation.
For his behavior.
He stole a chicken, I think. And maybe he was drinking. He's got some, I don't know. But anyway, what he had done was unacceptable to the group, and they took care of it. And so that was good that we had the...
the discipline. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that they let us do that.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you get together, when was the last reunion you went to?
Well, a year ago, we had one in St. Augustine, and two other women and I went to the 37th reunion. They had a reunion up in Macon, Missouri, and so we had gone up there, and so we were sitting around talking, and so we all decided that we needed to get a reunion of our group. Well, I should have known what would happen because we wanted to do it in February, which was when we were released. That just, you know, we feel like February is when we need to do something. And so Betsy lives in Kansas City, Kansas. And then Katie lives in Maryland, both of which in February are not the best places to go. So guess who got to do the most of the work? But it was really wonderful. It worked out fine. We went to St. Augustine. And the man that was here in town with the 37th, he helped me. And some of the 37th came. We had 40 of the original 500 that came. And one man is 90, sharp as a tack. And it's just amazing.
Now, are they all in the States now, or are they still some in Canada and some in Britain?
We had the British and the Canadians went back, you know, but they came. We had several people who came from England and Ireland to be with us for the reunion. And so, no, they all went back to their native countries, but there were a lot of people. My dad wanted to stay in the Philippines. He figured that he'd lost everything and he was going to have to start from scratch anywhere he went. And he wanted to stay in the Philippines, but mother said that she had her fill of the Philippines and she didn't want to stay. And she wanted us to come to school here in the States. And so daddy, I think he left his heart over there because I think he really loved it. Mm-hmm. But, and he had had a coconut plantation that he also was interested in trying to see if they could get any money out of because the Japanese took it. And but none of our family has ever visited the Philippines. I think that one of the sad things was mother never really adjusted after the war. She didn't ever forgive the Japanese. My brother was 4 when we went in and 7 when we came out. And I don't think he ever adjusted either. But my father was very optimistic, and I think I picked up on that. I decided that was a better way to be. I think, you know, life just is a little easier if you're looking for the good in it. And my dad forgave the Japanese, and I learned that that was a good thing to do because if you don't forgive, you're still a prisoner.
Well said. When you get together,
We have the best time.
what do you talk about when you get together?
Well, we just talk about what happened to us, and you know, and there, it's such a unique experience. There's nobody in the world that can relate to it. Our mm-hmm. families, I've heard the stories, but you have to live it to mm-hmm. to really. John McCain wrote in his book, Faith of Our Fathers, that you can't explain being a POW to anybody that hasn't been there. You just can't. Now, were you in the military?
Yes.
What mm-hmm. branch were you in?
I was in the Army.
Okay,
Vietnam.
Vietnam. Well, I hug all veterans, so I'm going to have to give you a hug when you leave. Because we just wouldn't be anywhere without them.
Yeah. So you get together and you talk about, you reminisce about the experiences. I guess you catch up with what everybody's doing.
Yes.
And then...
Yes, and we just have, and it's a happy group. I mean, you know, it's, It's family. I just can't say it any other way.
Has anybody ever written the story of the group?
Oh, yes. We've had several books.
Oh, good.
Yes. And I'm in the process of writing down stuff for my children simply because they won't leave me alone about it. and they tell me, it won't do us any good when you're senile. I hope that isn't right around the corner, but they're just about convinced me I better before I forget. So I was doing pretty well until Hugh died, and then that just brought it to a screeching halt. So now I'm trying to write down some stuff that I remember about him while I remember it for his children. So
are the stories that have been written about by others about your experience, do they capture everything you recall?
You know what's interesting is, we all had the same experience, but there are so many variations of that same experience in our memories. And I don't think that it's people have made it up. I think it's just they remember it differently, or they were a different age. And but it's a very close group, and next year they're going to have a reunion for just our group. Our reunion was just for our small group. The ones that were in Santo Tomas, which was 6,000, they meet every year because a lot of people settled in California. There's a big ex-POW group in California. Okay. They just never got any further. You know, it's like the Pilgrims landed over here and none of them ever got to the Pacific.
That's right.
Yeah.
They came off the ship on the West Coast and that's where they stayed.
That's where they stayed. Yeah. And a lot of folks did that too.
Yeah. Well, that's remarkable. Have you ever interacted with the St. Tomas group?
Yes. They came, they invited us to one of their reunions in San Antonio, and I went to that one. But it's a funny thing. We still get with the group, but we want to be over here with our own group.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. And you haven't been back, so if you go... Next year would be the first time you've returned since you departed.
For a long time, I thought, I got out of there one time. I just don't want to go through anything again like that. Well, there's no assurance of anything, you know. So I would like to see it again. It's a beautiful country.
Mm-hmm.
One of my sons was in the Peace Corps in Africa. And right now... He works for the University of Wisconsin, and he's taking a tour group to Vietnam. And they're there now. They'll be coming back the 3rd. And he says it is the most gorgeous country.
Vietnam's a beautiful country.
Yeah. He says the people.
I imagine the Philippines and Vietnam are a lot alike in terms of appearance and vegetation and the hills, mountains.
Well, I know this is off the subject of what we're talking about for me, but did you... have a hard time adjusting back to the States?
But I wasn't, you know, I wasn't out in the field on military operations like the infantry fellows were. So I had it quite a bit easier. And you know, the only time we were in danger was when we were mortared or shot at when we were out in convoy or something like that. But it was nothing like... the fellows were out in the field.
Well, and they had such a hard time when they came back. I think, you know, I'm not happy about the war in Iraq, but I'm glad we're supporting the troops. And I think that's what we should do.
Yeah.
Because it's not their fault they've been ordered to do whatever they're
doing. I think Vietnam's the only war where we actually blamed the troops for that.
That was so dumb.
We blamed everything and or blamed somebody for everything, and in one case we blamed the troops for it, which I think made it hard for those guys
that
were particularly on the front line.
Right.
Well,
back to the books. Some people, they have, there's one woman that wrote a book that changed everybody's name, and I know why she did it, was because she didn't want to be sued, probably, because she said some things about people that were probably... best left unsaid. And so, but that made people mad because the names were all changed. And I guess they had trouble figuring out who was who. Then we've had several books. The best book that's been written, to me, was the first one, and it was written by a man named Brenton Hines. I have a copy of it. Would you like to look at it?
Sure.
All right, let me go get it.